Earth changes, and now we're going to talk about Stan Dale's flying saucer technology when we come back. Also, we've got two Digicam pictures up there for you at coasttocoastam.com. The one at the top of the page, you might have to hit your refresh, the F5. But right at the top of the page, that's our Digicam photo of me in the studio with Marty Ingalls and Shirley Jones. And then in a few inches down, it's our board engineer Steve Carr's birthday. And take a look at the gift we gave him. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Stan Dale with us. And Stan, let's talk a little bit of this flying saucer technology this hour before we take calls next. A lot of people might really not understand that you do have some experience, not only in flying saucer technology, but in flying saucer information as well.
Yeah. As you kind of stated at the beginning of the show, I was once recruited by Dr. Edward Teller's group to develop my ideas and some that they had on propulsion techniques for a saucer-shaped craft. Sadly, that group has been shut down, taken over by a more powerful group nation or countrywide or worldwide, in the late 70s. And so as a result, I don't know who controls the technology now, but it's certainly not out in the public arena.
Is it more of a black ops program?
I think it is. Well, my personal opinion, although I never met him, is I know that they talked about an alien presence here on the planet and making contracts or treaties with them for exchange of technology for the aliens getting certain rights back from them. Now, I've never seen an alien, so I can't say that I can prove it that way by eyesight. But the documentation that was shown and the security people that I talked to within the organization did tell me they had actually seen them, several types. And I think that this is probably what is spoken of in Matthew 24, the Bible, where Jesus says that, look, in the end days of this age, before we go to the new happy times, you know, the millennial age, you're going to see imposter messiahs arrive with technology that will deceive many. And strange enough, I had a dream vision about that the other night that Holly's put up on the website under dream visions on the left there. But that's another story. But the thing is, the technologies that I was shown should have been released, I think, in the early 70s when I was inducted in the program. I think they should have been released to the public in certain parts. I can understand why we don't want to give terrorism access to real anti-gravity, and I plan to kind of honor that to a degree as far as public sales of these. But I want to teach people what the concept of gravity is, which allows the brighter out there to see how to use gravity as an energy source and as a propulsion source in the world to come. And if we do have all these disasters, which I think we will over a period of time, and it does break up the world, not just the United States, I'm looking at how do we reconstruct civilization from that. If some idiot uses an EMP bomb and destroys computers and anything with a microchip or chips in it anywhere in the world or wherever they drop them, that would put that country area back into the Stone Age unless we had new energy stuff that we could use to rebuild with. So all of the things I'm doing in my new company that Holly and I are doing are aimed at acquiring energy from some unusual sources, but to allow us to get electricity back into the grid or into local power supplies for groups of people, and to give people a mode of transport to allow them to go to seek medical help or food or water in some cases from areas that are so far away that by road it would be impossible. There's no waterway to it, so little mushroom-shaped saucer craft that are one- or two-man craft. We're making them with normal technology. The anti-gravity won't go into those. But by doing so, I will teach people the concept that the bumblebee uses to fly and that the hummingbird uses to hover. There's a way to recycle your wake energy. And that's been something I've been blessed with in dream visions probably 40 years ago. And now I understand it and have played with it for all that time and built boats. And, I'm now building these saucer craft to utilize the technology and the concept. But basically, it uses a philosophical principle and applies it to physics, and it's this. In philosophy, if you shove your way into a crowd of people in a crowded room, you're going to get resistance.
Right.
They're not going to be happy with you.
That's true. They may even shove you back.
Oh, definitely. That's what happens in the air or the water. When you push a boat or an aircraft through the air, you're intruding into the space where the atoms were residing quite happily before you got there. And so they push back. They reflect back your pushing energy. However, if you go into that crowded room, and before you enter, you say, look, excuse me, can you just make a hole? Let me come into this space.
And they move aside here and there.
Absolutely. And that's what we're doing with this technology, is teaching people, if you make a hole in the medium ahead of you, where the water, space, magnetic fields, gravitational fields, you can then drop your craft or yourself into that hole without disturbing the waters. And in our test with our marine version of the small-scale model boats, it's the darndest thing you'd ever see. I mean, the boat actually shoots water out ahead of it instead of out the back end and follows it. And it doesn't leave a wake. There's no trailing wake behind it. It's flat water, so you can water ski on a flat surface behind it. And it doesn't make a bow wave. It does carry waves out to the left and right of the boat that are like, if you stand on top of the boat and look down, they're like a figure eight to the left and right, you know, the piece of figure eight, and it's like waves within that. And that travels along, makes it look like a water spider, you know, hooking through the water. But that happens in the aircraft version as well.
Well, are you in partnership at all with Paul Muller, or is this totally different now?
It's different at the moment, and I got to tell you, my long-term hope is to join forces with Paul. I have sent him an email, which probably got lost in the zillions of emails he gets, but I did try to make contact with him last year to say, look, let's join forces, because you've done a lot of the homework, the technical parts of it, but the theory part here is something that will increase the efficiency of your...
Yeah, you sound like a different form of propulsion system than what he's using.
Well, yeah, he's using a ducted fan direct thrust device, which is still shoving you. But we could adapt what he has done to certainly increase the efficiency of it by about double. Less fuel, same speed and whatever. But I understand one of the big problems he has is with the Aeronautical Association here, is that he's giving people the ability to take a hovercraft and not use highways and fly all over the country. And he has had to develop triple redundant computer systems.
Right, in case something happens.
Well, you don't want him landing up in your living room because a guy was drunk coming home.
Or falling down on you wherever you might be on the ground.
Absolutely. And see, they
I think they only go 9 feet tall, though, high, though.
The first ones he's putting out, that's true. Those are little saucer shaping. But if you look at his more like jet body, four ducted fan, rotating fan version, that will go faster, higher, you know, and that one becomes a danger. But even with the one he's limiting it to 9 feet with limiters, which, you know, clever fellows will probably figure out a way to go around. And, of course, if they have an accident, then they'll be to blame, but it'll still cause an accident. What I've aimed at in the company is to try to reduce the amount of energy we're using in trucks and trains and planes and boats, submarines, and make a new kind of craft for the water and the air. And we've even started designing some things as they would have to be primary manufacturing changes to automobile manufacturers, but they're not aftermarket. But that would help there at over 60 miles an hour to save a lot of the fuel that people use now. Just by recirculating the wake energy.
Now, his unit would cost, the flying saucer one, $100,000.
Right.
What's your idea on this little two-seater?
I'm looking at something that will have a gasoline motor, some shrouding. Let's see. I think we figured out that it would be, in a kit form you put together yourself, less than about $30,000.
And you make it? You could make it yourself?
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Well, I want people to understand it and be able to repair it, so that's why we're looking at making a kit for them. The first things that will come out will be scale model kits, you know, that you can get at Hobby Lobby or something like that.
Okay, all right.
And that's to show people how to steer them with the remote control and things like that, see how the air patterns work, what the attitude control works like.
Is that an actual picture that you've sent us that's on the coasttocoastam.com website, linked to yours?
That's one of our ray trace renditions. I had to take the top off of it, so I had to use a ray trace rendition. And also, what's on the our craft will not look entirely like that when we go to the man version. That's the RC version. Because we're going to have a different place for the person to sit or stand than you would see in that thing there, because it'd have to be too big otherwise. And also because we're still filing patents, I can't show everything on the top shelf.
Just make them here, not in China.
Oh, listen, that's one of my biggest fears, George. I know you're being, kind of lighthearted about that, but...
But I am serious, too.
Yeah, well, look at the patent office where I've been doing the patents we're doing now. They've got a Chinese desk there, and they sit there, and as soon as a patent becomes unsealed, which means it's been approved and it's now allowed to be made public, they're sitting there watching all the new stuff coming through, and they take what they want. They take it back home. They make it, export it to everywhere they
want. Make it cheaper, unfortunately.
And they don't honor the IATA patent treaty between the United States and other countries. They don't honor that. So they just steal it. It's just absolutely stealing. And Mr. Clinton started that nonsense. And, so we've looked at ways to make that, to fight that by keeping it in America as far as what Americans use. We know they're going to steal it overseas. That's a given.
That's going to happen, sure.
I'm looking at helping Americans. That's my job. I live here. I'm a citizen here. And that's what we're doing it for, is the Americans. And if they want to steal it and send it overseas, the Chinese, well, at least we'll have the technology out there for people to use.
Timetable for something like this, Stan?
For the models or what?
For both, I guess.
Okay, well, we hope by June of next year to have our kit model thing of the aircraft and possibly the marine craft ready for manufacturing. And then it'll be up to us, to our marketing division, to... get that to the public as quick as possible. And I would say after that it would be about 90 days. The tooling at this point doesn't seem to be excessive, and we're learning things every day about how to cut back costs on it so that it can get down even cheaper, what I've said. But the price I gave you, $25,000-$30,000 for a manned version, is a wild guess, a WAG wag, because... so many things could change between now and then in the sources of our product components. But that version, the manned version, will be in development as soon as we turn the kits over to the manufacturing marketing division. We're going to start on the manned version then.
Okay.
And I'll test that. I will personally test that.
You will be calling us live while you're in one. Deal?
Okay, deal. Deal.
How high will you go again with this? What's the capabilities?
Its capabilities will be like an ultralight aircraft. In fact,
that's way up there then.
Yeah, we're making it so that it will have about three times the range of a normal ultralight aircraft for the same amount of fuel, and will be a lot safer in a power failure. It'll kind of parachute itself down from the structure itself.
For a power failure to occur, what would that be? Just a complete shutdown?
Let's say you run out of fuel. Let's say you get a fuel blockage. You got some dirty fuel in there.
And this is gasoline?
We're going to have a gasoline version, and hopefully we'll be able to make a small enough diesel version to do that, or an LPG or like a propane gas fire.
Okay, so hydrogen's not in the picture for something like
that. No, I wouldn't say that, but that's a little further down the line. We've got to have something that will generate the hydrogen from another energy source,
right,
to fuel it. And we've even looked at putting hydrogen in the craft itself to reduce its mass or its weight to comply with the American standards for ultralight weights. I think we have to stay within 245 pounds. So we're talking a lightweight aircraft here. And you probably won't want to go too high because of oxygen at 10,000 feet, because it gets colder. And you want to try to stay, close to the ground and under the radar, just enjoy yourself, but be sensible about it. You don't want to get into the air traffic lane.
No, that would not be a very smart thing to do.
No, we might have to govern it. I don't know. But there are a number of engineering problems we have to face when we go to the different type of power sources. And I am looking at another one, an electrical one, that I will talk about one of these days. But with the gasoline and diesel, with the combustion type engines, whether it be hydrogen or propane or whatever, these things traditionally run horizontal to the ground, and so we've had to devise new ways to run motors vertically, new types of bearing hookups to keep it from wearing out the armature too quick.
And it's doable?
Pardon?
Doable?
Oh, yeah, doable, yeah. I mean, thrust bearings and other things we're looking at. It's just an engineering problem. It's not a concept problem. It's getting the components the right price and the right size to fit in what we want.
Wow, Mr. Dale, is this reverse UFO technology here?
This part isn't. If you look on our website under the splash page, that purple page, and you click on energy and propulsion talking points, you will see down at the bottom of the pictures we've got there some of the long-range stuff that is kind of reverse engineering it away. I was exposed to the technology before I was recruited by Teller's group, and you'll see some chipboard down there in three layers, like a birthday cake or a wedding cake or something, with some coils and rods on it, and that was the technology I was familiar with. But the Teller Maxfield, or sorry, Teller, well, and others, Maxfield, Sakharov, that group had developed it beyond that by the time I joined them to the thing you see in the middle. It looks like a metal donut with flat wire toroidal coils around it. And how you use that is a secret, but that's what it looked like inside a 30-foot craft. I was shown the Polaroids of that in a meeting in the group.
Incredible propulsion, Stan.
Oh, look.
My gosh.
It is. And the thing is, I'm a teacher at heart. I like to share with folks, and I like to see young engineers and physicists' minds suddenly turn on to the new concepts and then run like crazy with their own applications of it. I'm not so vain to think that I have the greatest mind and the only solution to everything in the world, so I want to share it. And this is what I'm doing within the confines of keeping a profitable business, you know, with proprietary property and stuff like that, but still teaching the concept. And you'll see on this page, I've gone to great lengths. In fact, what you're seeing on this technology page here in the talking point are extracts from a paper that I have begun submitting to the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical Engineers in this country. And I discussed with them what I was doing and gave them part one to show the error in Einstein's relativity and how it affects gravity and energy, our concepts of it, and how we use it. And they were so excited about it. They've taken it off now, and it's getting peer reviews now. And part two and part three, parts of that are already here before I've even turned them over to the IEEE. And they've assured me that should they go to an e-book publication of this, that we will be able to make it available to the public on our website. And we will do that in agreement with the contract that we will sign with them. But the thing about gravity, you know, I never thought that I would be challenging such a great person as Einstein or Lorentz Fitzgerald.
Or Isaac Newton.
Yeah. In fact, I just kind of hold him up on a pedestal in physics. I mean, Newton was a tremendous Christian fellow, but he was also a tremendous physicist, and he was a bit eccentric in his own way. But yet, he pioneered all of our modern physics, you know, thrust reaction-type devices and all kinds of physics applied to the formulas he devised. Well, you know, how close are we to a break?
You've got about a minute or so. Go ahead.
Okay, after break, I better talk about it. It'll probably take me a longer time, but I want to tell you a weird thing that happened to me in 1969 in my den, which got me started on this long path to finding the error in Einstein's relativity, because it was a freaky kind of supernatural thing that you know, people could see.
That's why this show is so appropriate for things like that, Stan.
Well, yeah, I at the time it happened, I thought, wow, that's really incredible. Well, what do I do with it? And then 35 years of exploration followed. But I guess we can talk about that just after the break.
Okay, let's do that. And Stan, also, I want to talk with you about your thoughts of this UFO deception and what it might really be. I haven't talked with you about this in a long time. Most of the things you and I always talk about are these incredible Earth changes. So let's do that as well, all right?
All right.
All right, Stan Dale. His website is Stan, D-E-Y-O, StanDale.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Take a look at some of the things we've been talking about tonight. His flying saucer designs, his thoughts on just what will happen Earth-wise in the future. I'll be back in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, those of you who are Streamlink members, tomorrow night, special chat, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Eastern time, with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Her website, visionaryliving.com. She's an expert in dreams, angels, werewolves, devils, ghosts. She's one of the best. So go ahead and chat with her on your computer tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Pacific time. What strange thing happened to you, Stan, in 1969?
Well, it was just a little bit before Christmas time, and I was in Dallas at the time. I hadn't joined the teller group thing, and my wife and I were sitting down in the den where I had kind of been allowed to put a, you know, a Stanley Thinking couch and a fireplace and a blackboard and a desk and the equipment that I could experiment with. And on my blackboard, you know, just a normal blackboard, black with, you know, white chalk, I was sitting down next to the desk there in a chair reading a book that one of my staff at the office had given me as an early Christmas present, and it was a paperback biography on the life of Einstein. And the wife was down there wrapping packages and stuff for Christmas, and I was reading and really enjoying this in the evening there, this biography, until I hit a line where it said Einstein was not happy with his general relativity. He knew he had an error in it.
Huh.
And the reason he did, he said, was that light coming from the sun, for instance, he said, travels across this vast space to the earth and other places. He said, it travels across nothing, and it acts like a waveform. He says, that doesn't fit with the way I've done general relativity. There's an error there that has to be solved. So I thought, wow, a waveform. I'll go over to the blackboard here, and I'll draw a big sun, and I put the chalk on the left side of the board and drew this round sun, and then I put up a bunch of dots in a grid to the right of that. In fact, you can see I've recreated what I saw there. This is not the actual photo, so don't get panicky. But I've recreated what we saw because we didn't take pictures of when it happened. But anyway, I put the dots up on the blackboard, and I thought, right, I can figure out a way that light photons acting like waves and particles can actually kick themselves along through nothingness. And so I put all these dots and started making a little movement of the atoms or the photons, as it was, to see if it could do that without something being in the space between the sun and the earth. And I thought, oh, no, that won't work. And I erased it in disgust at how I should even try to solve this great man's problem with drawings on a blackboard, and sat back down. So I picked up the book I was reading. I'm really enjoying that, right? I pick it up, and I look at the words on the page, and they could be in Cyrillic Russian for all it mattered. I could not understand or read a single word. My mind, somehow or another, stopped being able to read. And I mentioned to the wife, I said, you're not going to believe this, but I can't read.
Well, you must have been freaking.
Oh, I thought, what's wrong with my mind?
Yeah, she something's said, happening. You're stroking out or something.
Yeah, and she says, don't worry about it. You know how wives are. Don't worry about it.
Have a stroke. Don't worry, Stan.
Yeah. No, she says, you were working with something on the blackboard there, weren't you? I said, yeah. She says, well, your mind's probably still over there, and it can't concentrate in this, and that's all that's happening. I said, right. She said, well, go back to the blackboard and finish what you're doing over there, and whatever it is in your mind, correct itself. I said, right. So I went over to the blackboard thinking, what in the world am I going to do that I, you know, didn't do before? And I put my chalk in my right hand and put it up in the middle of the blackboard to think, well, what will I draw next? And as I was looking at my hand in the chalk absentmindedly, I realized there was a picture formed in the eraser marks that was so clear it was a side view of Albert Einstein's head. And I thought, wow, I must be really seeing things now. And so I turned to the missus and I said, look, I want to ask you a question. And she says, before you do, who's that picture up on the blackboard? I said, you see that? She said, oh, yeah. I said, that's Albert Einstein. And I told her, you know, how it formed just by accident. When I erased before I sat down, she says, oh, that's neat. Leave it up there. And so for a couple of days, neighbors came in. Everybody looked at it, but stupid here, forgot to take a picture of it. So I recreated kind of like what it looked like in those pictures on the website there. But anyway, I then went back and sat down and could read again. And then in the weeks that followed, I started to have really lucid dreams where I could ask a question in my dream about how space works and stuff, and it actually, I would go out in like 3D space and color between the sun and the earth and see how everything worked, how gravity worked.
You get the answers that way, didn't you?
Oh, In pictures.
Yeah.
You know, and then I had to take several years to learn the mathematics to, you know, convey this to the physicists in their language. And when I say several years, probably about 35 years. I'm a slow learner. But now I finally have the opportunity to share that and to take this to completion. But it was just so freaky that reading Einstein, then his picture forms out of the eraser marks at random. You know, it had to be something telling me, look, you can do it, and just hang in there. And I don't know where the information came from after that. I can guess it's by the grace of God. But anyway, that's what I'm sharing with folks in this IEEE paper. And in fact, you want me to tell you how gravity kind of works generally?
Yeah.
Okay.
From your perspective.
Well, all right, from my perspective. That's fair enough. Einstein Michelson and Morley, Lorentz in the early days, Sir Isaac Newton, Maxwell, all these people looked at space as a fluid, what they called the ether, or A-E-T-H-E-R, aether space.
Right.
And they only put an A in front of it because at the time ether was
It was that snuffing out thing, chemical.
A stuff to put you to sleep or burn or whatever, ether, the chemical. And so they didn't want to confuse ether space with that because they called space like a fine vaporous medium, which, of course, ether becomes when it evaporates. So that's how they came to call it that. But anyway, these guys all thought about the effects of space, especially James Clerk Maxwell, as gravity, magnetism, electricity, all of them were functions of waveforms of certain descriptions in a fluid space.
All right.
Space. Well, the thing that kind of turned the ball around and told all the people that thought that way, go home, you're wrong, was when Michelson and Morley did an experiment to see how fast the speed of light went and if they could test the theory that the Earth was moving through ether space. And very simply, the way they did it was to take a light beam and split it in half. Half the light beam went out to the right of us as we were moving around the sun, and the other half went ahead of us and then reflected back from some mirrors they had on the surface of the Earth. Same thing with that went out to the right. And they thought, if we are moving through space, and they went through the trigonometry of it, then the light beam that goes out to the side and comes back will travel further than the one going ahead and bouncing back. And no need to discuss why, but they did find from this that there was no change in the speed of light as it traveled at greater distance on the right side versus the one going ahead. And they said, therefore, the Earth is not moving through an ether space. There is no ether space. And this experiment and the conclusions they drew and everyone else looked at their experiment drew and repeated versions of it at that time drew was that the limit velocity in space is the speed of light. Therefore, you can't go faster or slower than that as a light waveform. Electromagnetic wave, and therefore Albert Einstein jumped on that after two other guys, Lorentz and Fitzgerald, made a fudge factor to put into what Einstein used to put into his equation. Actually, Lorentz did it before he did, but all they did was set up a fudge factor to accommodate the results of that experiment so that they could understand it. And it was a simple, simple mistake that they all made, and that was this. And you can see this. Let's suppose we have a cup of tea, you know, white tea with cream in it, and we've stirred it up, and there's a few tea leaves that got out of the bag, and they're floating around the spinning tea.
Right.
Okay, let's call the center of that spin the sun, and let's call those tea leaves planets. Now, look down at those tea leaves orbiting around the center of the spinning tea. Do you see any shock waves or bow waves on those tea leaves? No.
No.
They are being moved by the ether, or by the T in this case, at the same speed as the T or the ether. Therefore, if you did a test like Michelson and Morley did, you wouldn't detect the ether because you're not moving through it. It is moving you. That is the basic relativity concept there that they missed. When you bring that back into their equation, a marvelous thing happens. We can go many times the speed of light where you actually curl space, the fluid of space, ahead and around
you. You're talking about time travel now, Stan.
Well, I know the Israelis have recently postulated that using a torus,
yep,
a donut-shaped thing, to go back in time as long as you can surround it with exotic matter. I don't know exactly what exotic matter is, but that's what they said. I definitely know that you can see back in time. If you can go faster than light and go away from the Earth for, say, a year at that speed, and turn around and look at the light coming from the Earth, from our solar system, the light you'll be getting will be a year ago. And you can actually witness events, at least on a solar system scale, from a year ago, because you're out there catching those light rays that are going out into space. It's like we do now. We actually are using time viewing of the beginning of the universe and of galaxies that are long gone because they're, you know, 500 million light years away. Well, 500 million years ago, you know, okay, they formed and did their thing, and we're just now getting the light from it. So we're seeing back in time 500 million years. As far as going forward in time, that's a different proposition, and I think we can actually take mass forward in time, but not backward, at least.
Well, that's what most scientists and physicists say, exactly that, except this Israeli physicist says no. He believes that with this bending space-time, you might be able to go back into time.
Well, all right, and I'll certainly be big enough to say that's possible, and I will tell you this. If anybody has done that in the modern history of the human race up to this point in time, then whatever they've done in the past is already set.
And by the way, this Israeli says you do not need exotic matter to do this.
Oh, did he?
Everybody else says you do.
I must have misread that.
Okay, so
he's that the other day.
Yeah, he's on the other side of the camp, and he stands alone.
Oh, that's right. He said you could have dust or something, didn't
right.
he?
Right.
That's right. That's right. I remember. Well, look, you know, we've often had a joke with university professors arguing this time travel thing, and now that America's seen Doctor Who, they can imagine a time cabinet being able to go back and forward in time. And I said to one of them, I said, look, let's suppose that a man invents, or a company, whatever, invents a time machine that will go back in time, forward in time, anywhere they want.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, the first man goes into there and disappears into the time stream.
And where did he go, by the way?
We don't know.
All right.
Backwards, forwards. He's gone into the
time stream. He's gone. Okay.
From that moment on, if there was no God, then there always was one. Now think about it. He's gone back or forward in time. He figures out a way to increase his life, to live forever, whatever. And so it doesn't matter. God always was.
True.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a freaky thing, and it always ties their mind in a knot. I leave them, go get another canapé and do something else. But it's a mental game. But the point is, I think that certainly to this point in time, that everything that has or could be done to the timeline behind us by anybody from the future or from God or whatever has been done. The future to us is still unwritten, but to those who stand outside in the time stream, they see it like slides in a carousel that they can manipulate. Forward and backward. But to us as the observer, we're in that carousel as a fixed slide, and we can only see what's happening in our slide and guess at what's coming in the future and certainly see what has happened in the past.
I didn't know you were this technically inclined.
Really?
All these years, you know, I knew you were an expert in earth changes and climate and earthquake predictions, but I knew, you know, because obviously I've been following your career, but I didn't know you were this technically inclined.
Well, I don't know why. I guess I didn't talk about it. I know we had a good time over there in Hollywood when we did that show with you, but that was on, you know, other matters that are more common to the show. So I guess I just...
You're multifaceted, Mr. Dale.
Yes. What was it? A newspaper article or a journalist down in Australia once came out to see the lab and stuff, and he filmed it and did a full-page Sunday edition on it, and he ended up calling me the modern-day Da Vinci, and I thought, wow, that's a real plus, you know. But I just have an interest in everything around me, and fortunate enough to be able to rationalize it in things I can share with
you. You do have some work out, a DVD, as a matter of fact, called UFOs Are Here.
Yeah.
Let's take some time before we take calls next hour. Tell me about this concept. UFOs Are Here.
Well, UFOs Are Here was a three-part documentary that was produced by Guy Baskin, a British documentary producer for the Channel 9 network in Australia. And they called me in to be, I think, the last 20 minutes of the first of three documentaries. They were only going to do one. And when they took my story and interviewed me and saw the data about the group I'd worked with under Teller there, they realized that there was a bigger story about this UFO presence and the technology that we had. So they extended and had an audience in the next one, and then flew me up to the north to look at some UFO sightings up in the Pilbara. And the upshot of it was the first one is the UFOs Are Here documentary, which was really probably the best of the lot as far as let me tell the story my way and to see what others were saying, including Steven Spielberg and Alan Hynek. I mean, we had the who's who of UFO research in that that DVD. And sadly, when the company was, the Channel 9 was being sold over to the Bond Network, they cleaned out what we call the Pizza Hut room, which was all the film canisters and tapes were, and they destroyed the masters.
Oh, no.
So we had to find a VHS copy that someone had, and I spent weeks, probably months, tidying it up and restoring it from, you know, how
the best way you could, I guess. Yeah.
And it's come up really nice. And so I made a deal with Channel 9 for historical purposes, and we pressed 1,000 copies of it to share with folks because they thought it was important as well. So now, in that, obviously at the time, if you see the DVD, you'll see that it was talking from a position in 1977, I think it was, about what people knew about the UFO situation and what the experts were saying about the alien. Now, as I said to you before, I am not sure. You know, I have not seen an alien, but I know from biblical accounts and from Hopi accounts and other accounts in the Middle East that beings that were not from around here but were humanoid have visited Earth, according to these records, for thousands of years. And so I think probably, in my opinion, that these are beings that, the majority of them anyway at this point in time, are beings that don't have our best interest at heart, and it's due to a war that's happening in a universe that's concentric to our own, maybe several, you know, parallel universes. And this is why I'm born in the cosmic conspiracy. The first messiahs, in quote, that you see in flying saucers arriving say, "We mean you no harm," like the movie V.
To Serve Man, the Twilight Zone. You remember that one?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That
same
was,
thing.
They were on the menu there.
Yeah.
But it's an even bigger. Well, actually, I suppose it could be the same way. You could treat it that way here. What we're having happen now is the world has multiple crises that you and I and many of your guests have talked about. Multiple serious crises for humanity in the world. And they're all coming to a head now, and so we're all saying, hey, can somebody fix this? I mean, hey, you know, God, are you out there? I mean, hey, we're in trouble. And then suddenly, in fly, our quote-unquote alien messiahs who, you know, say, look, we created you, blah, 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 we've come to help you, just follow the rules that we set up for a global government, and we'll appoint a leadership here and give them technology to help you. Now, what I'm telling you comes out of Ezekiel in the Bible. So, you know, it's written in old English and Bible speak, but it's there, talking about an alien or a group of alien gods, it says, who come to Earth and help the leader, the Antichrist leader of this age, to take down the strong fortresses of all the great nations and to rule the world for a short time. And that's the great deception coming, and it's going to fool a lot of people to go to church every Sunday into thinking that, oh, well, yeah, that must be the Messiah.
Yeah, you know? And it's not.
It's not, and we are warned many times in Scripture, beware the fake first and hold out for the real guy.
Stay with us, Stan. We're going to be back. We're going to take phone calls next. By the way, the L.A. Times did a huge expose on that Haitian UFO that we thought looked so great, even though we warned everyone that it probably wasn't real. Well, they found the guy in Europe who created it, and they did admit he was darn good.